The next presentation is going to be by Craig Daughtry. What you've just heard Doug talk about in terms of corn stover residue, those are site-specific experiments looking at available residues. Again, for the regional or national need, we have to be able to scale that up. We have to be able to look at available residues across the nation. That feeds into Craig Daughtry's talk, which is mapping crop residue cover at field to regional scales. Craig Daughtry and his team at USDA ARS Hydrology and Remote Sensing Lab are certainly among the best in the nation at this and have been working at this for quite a long time. This is the only one that's a PDF, I think. So I'm not sure how to view. Full screen. Thank you. Okay, Craig.
Thank you, Tris. As you said, I'm just the person that's up speaking. I have quite a team behind me, both in Bellsville, Washington, in Ames, and in Indiana, working with. What I'd like to do today is give just a brief overview of some of the spectral properties of vegetation, residues, and soils, and some of the primary factors that will affect reflectance, and look at some spectral indices for residue assessment. Looking at some of our work from scaling up from lab to field to landscape measurements, and finally look at what are some of the prospects using current and future sensors for mapping residue cover over large areas. We've been talking a lot about residue today, and what I'm considering this is just what comes out, what's left in the field after harvest. In the fall, it's usually very bright, fairly fluffy, you might say, in the field. But as it goes through the winter, the residue is often laid on the soil surface more. It's darker. As we go through and till it, there's less residue. And finally, maybe when it's been intensively tilled, there's very little residue left on the soil surface. How do we measure crop residue cover? The primary method is the line point transect, which is basically a string with beads on it, and at each marker you make an assessment. Is it soil or is it residue? And the factors that affect the accuracy of this are the length of the line, the number of points, and the size of the residue. And if you look at this bottom slide, the line transect seldom lays on the soil surface, and so it's a lot of skill in the operator, because in Indiana and Iowa that string is vibrating across there, and so you're trying to make a measurement assessment of what the mean cover is there, mean coverage of a point. The second way of doing this is usually with a windshield survey, and this is when we're using trained observers stopping at traveling along a fixed route and just stopping occasionally and making an assessment of the field into visual categories. And there's differences among observers on that. So the key thing on this is that the traditional methods of measuring residue cover, I think, are really inadequate for large fields, for many fields, and for large areas. In this slide, I'd like to just show you, we've plotted reflectance factor versus wavelength, going from visible 400 nanometers to 2400 nanometers. And I'm showing Landsat bands and Aster bands. Landsat is one of the major type sensors that are satellite sensors that we've been using. For green vegetation, it's low reflectance in the visible, and then high reflectance in the near infrared out to around 12 to 1400. Whereas with soils and residues, they're very low reflectance. I mean, their reflectance is monotonically increasing through the visible and near infrared, and it's not until you get out to around 2100 nanometers that you see some differences that really occur in that. In the visible near infrared, the residues may be brighter or darker than the soils, and it varies during the year. What we're looking at in the 2100 nanometer region is that there's an absorption feature primarily related to cellulose, and we can measure that depth of that feature. Soils, on the other hand, have more of a convex shape in that region. Green vegetation has got lots of water, and it's essentially masks the absorption feature. Moving on here, what we're doing is essentially drawing a line between the two peaks here, one at 2,000, 2,200, and then measuring the depth of this feature. And that feature is linearly related to residue cover. Soils, on the other hand, have more like a convex shape. There's a mineral absorption around 2,200. This is associated with some of the clay minerals. But you generally don't, and it appears in most soils. If we look at reflectance properties of soils and crop residues, the key thing to note here is that the residues can be brighter or darker than the soils. The barn soils is a mollusk soil from Minnesota. The Cordoris, a fairly bright soil from Maryland area. As the soils get wet, you know, they get darker, as we've all seen. But it also dampens the absorption features, both in the crop residues and in the soils. So this absorption feature that we see in dry residue essentially disappears when it's saturated. Likewise, the absorption feature due to the minerals in the Cordoris disappears in wet. Then finally, as the crop residues decompose, their reflectance generally decreases. You've seen residues that become much darker after the winter, but that's in the visible near infrared. As you go on out into the shortwave infrared, they actually may get brighter. So what I've shown you so far is laboratory measurements. We're scaling up to field measurements now, where we're using a portable spectroradiometer in the field that covers 350 to 2,500 nanometer wavelength range. We've mounted a digital camera along on the pole with that, so that for each spectra we have a photograph, and we've determined the area within the photograph that the spectrometer is seeing, and then we can assess residue cover within that area. Using the technique I showed earlier, we've measured residue cover in several hundred. 400 or 500 points, and there is a general relationship between the cellulose absorption index, that value out around 2,200 nanometers that we're talking about, and residue cover. But you notice that it's a fairly broad line, and that what's happening here is that as we on different dates we got different slopes of the line, and what we've determined from that was that it's effect of moisture content in the scene. As the water content increases, the slope of the line goes more vertically. You see the absorption features tend to disappear. But we can, when we plot the slope of the relationship between residue cover and CAI versus residue water content, there's just a scattering of points, 3 points essentially. But we can also estimate that with those three bands that we were looking at for calculating residue cover. The two peaks on either side of the cellulose absorption feature, as the water content changes, their relative height changed each other. And so we can use that ratio, the same three bands that we were calculating the cellulose absorption index with, to estimate the change in slope and actually improve our estimates for residue cover. And it looks like that these relationships are fairly robust. They can be extendable from 1 year to the next. Okay, let's scale up again. We're going from using aircraft data, fairly small aircraft, to jet, high altitude aircraft, and finally to satellite data. They all have about the same spectral range, different spatial resolutions, and different signal to noise ratios, I might add. This is a study where we looked in central Iowa in the spring. The planning progress for that part of the state in for the week ending May 9th, that had over 90% of the corn planted and over half the soybeans had been planted. We went to the field, used the line point transect, and measured 50 to 60 fields on May 10th to 12th. And we had Hyperion imagery that were acquired on May the 3rd and then later in June. From that, from the locations that we measured in the field, we estimated residue cover and extracted from the Hipparion imagery the locations within the field, calculated the Salus absorption index, and we've plotted it here for both the corn and the soybeans. We get an R-square in this case of about 0.78. And I might mention that the slope that we see for the line for the satellite data, in this case, is very similar to what we've measured for the ground-based data and the aircraft data in Indiana, Maryland, and Iowa. So anyway, we're taking this relationship, estimating residue cover for the whole scene. This happens to be Ames, Iowa, in this area. And then combining that with the crop land data layer, the crop type for 2003. And what we have then is we have tillage classes along the top here, with intensive tillage being less than 15% residue cover, reduced tillage being 15 to 30%, and conservation tillage greater than 30% residue cover. So for an example, for the 2003 corn crop, by May 2004, we had 18% of the land was in intensive tillage, 36% in reduced tillage, and 45% as conservation tillage. You can do the same thing for soybeans across there. The overall average for that year was a quarter of the land was in intensive tillage, and the rest, and 38% in reduced tillage, and the balance in conservation tillage. That was for 2004. When we moved to 2005 and repeated the experiment, we see a quite different pattern in tillage practices. 2005 was a little bit wetter and drier, a little bit wetter and cooler, and so we had less intensive tillage. And what we find is that overall, the amount of intensive tillage decreased quite a bit, and you have much more residue left on the soil surface. So what we're seeing, I think, is an interaction between time that the farmers have to till, conditions for tilling, and planting. And how much? Okay, conclusions from this portion of the study is that I think we can use relationships that are based on ground-based sensors. They're extendable to aircraft and space-borne sensors. The narrow band spectral bands that we've shown for measuring residue absorption intensity are linearly related to residue cover. Our classification accuracy was up at least 80% for these three categories of residue cover. And I think we can do maps of residue cover and tillage practices across landscapes. But now, let's do a little bit of reality check here. When we start looking at sensors that are available right now to do this, from a hyperspectral data, the sensors that are available right now are Hipparion. And Hipparion was launched in 2000. It's about 7 or 8 years past its lifetime, expected lifetime. The next one to come online is probably going to be the German NMAP sensor, scheduled for 2012. And NASA has put a hyperspectral system in their plans, but it's at least middle of the next decade. Aircraft sensors, there's the NASA Avris sensor, which is probably the gold standard for hyperspectral imaging instruments. There are commercial systems like the Spectir, ASA, and similar type systems. And there's some satellite multispectral systems out there. We'd say advanced multispectral systems that would have multiple square shortwave infrared bands. There's a proposal with the Jet Propulsion Lab to produce such an instrument, and the Indian Resource Sat may add additional bands to their satellite. So let's look at what we got in hand now, the current sensors. There's the Landsat system, which is also aging. There's the replacement for that is years off. The SPOT with about 15 meter resolution, three visible bands, one shortwave infrared band. The Resource Sat's AWIFS sensor has, again, three visible near infrared bands and one shortwave infrared band, and finally you got MODIS, but it's got fairly large, very large pixels in this. We use the spectral indices that we have for the Landsat type sensors, and what I'm going to show here is just some data that we use from Maryland using TM bands 5 and 7. The relationship is generally not very good between residue cover and these spectral indices, no matter which one you choose. So these broadband indices are not robust, I would say. We thought, well, perhaps it's just a combination of the residue cover and the soils that we're using in Maryland. So we went to the study put out by David Brown, where he measured some 4,000 soils from the National Soil Classification Center, and we chose surface soils from his data set, some 893 soil samples, grouped them by soil order, and calculated the various indices. And what I've plotted here are the box and whisker plots. So the box represents 25 to 75% percentile range of the data. The whiskers are the lower, are the 10% and 90% range, and then the individual points are, you know, the ones that are outside the upper 10% or the lower 10% range. For the normalized difference tillage index, again, this is using bands 5 and 7, it looks like we could probably identify crop residues with this. They're generally greater. The ones in red are crop residues, by the way, generally have a higher value than the soils. However, if we go to some of the other indices that do not use band 7, such as it would be with AWIFS or with SPOT, it would be very difficult to have a residue index that would work over a large number of soils with these. So what are you left with? The way that you could do crop residue cover over larger areas now is that you're essentially going to be doing classifications of that. And for that, an example of that we used, this is a spring image, AWIFS image over Iowa. And you can see there's quite a bit of variability in soil color within the image. The small box here is the spot image, which is 60 kilometers on the side, and it's over the South Fork watershed. And even there, and if you look at the image carefully, there's quite a bit of variation in soil color. We used roadside windshield surveys in March 2008 and looked at approximately 750 corn and soybean fields and just grouped them into broad classes. And the reason we did that is when you start looking at these data is that it's hard to separate out the corn and soy, hard to separate out the different tillage levels. So we came up with just three classes, three for corn, an intensive tillage, a reduced tillage, and one that has not been tilled, no till. And for soybeans, it's just a two class, either tilled or not tilled. Again, using the AWIFS data over a major portion of Iowa, we could assess, I think, tillage practices in limited number of classes with about 85% accuracy. What you find that overall, there's a difference, well, this is for April 2008, that roughly a third of the land had been tilled and two-thirds had not been tilled. If you had an image a little bit later on, you could assess it maybe right after planting would be a better time for that. So what do we come out from this? And our conclusions is that I think the narrow band indices like CAI are probably your most robust indicators for soil residue. The broadband indices are not going to be robust, but you can still do classifications of residue cover categories using classification algorithms. This means that you will have to do training statistics that are each time. They're not extendable in time or space. And, you know, soil type, residue age, seen moisture, and atmospheric conditions are going to affect your classifications. And finally, I think in order to really use this over large areas, what we're going to need to do is develop some strategies that would allow us to use sort of limited hyperspectral data and many frames of multispectral data to assess larger areas with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. The importance of what you just heard here really can't be overstated. We used to have the CTIC data that gave us an idea of tillage across the U.S., and we don't have that anymore. This is something that can potentially provide us estimates on an annual basis when it's done at a larger scale to give us an idea of tillage treatments and available residues. We've got a few minutes if we want to go into a discussion or there's any questions. I can take those now, then we'll go into a break. We're going to come back and go into forest residues. So are there any questions, or is everybody pretty worn out at this point?
I have one. Okay. Second speaker. In your slide where you showed global distribution of land uses based on carbon policies, of course, you showed when we did not account for terrestrial losses, a huge increase in bioenergy cost at the expense of forestry. A huge increase in bioenergy crops. What crops were those? What was the primary tillage in there in that case as a bioenergy crop to give that much total land use?
Well, what happened is that normally the bioenergy crops that are being grown there, but the displacement of the bioenergy crops into the land use for food and fiber production, and therefore forcing the other crops, the food and fiber crops, to enter into land of less quality, and that's why the potential increase in value crops. I forget now exactly. I have to read the paper, but these are kind of generic. It doesn't have the details of specific value crops.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.